So in the movie Facing the Giants, huge spoiler alert. This movie came out about 06. I'm a big fan of what these people are doing and how they're doing it. It's a Christian. You probably see the picture in the bottom here on your left. There's a man there, Alex Kendrick. He's actually been the driving force behind several movies now. They're very much Christian oriented, and it's amazing the quality he's putting together when so much of the cast and the crew are actually volunteers and members of his church in Georgia. So he's doing a great work. I really love what he's doing. It's bringing solid Christian messages to media, and I think that's great because we don't always have that with what we see in movies. So when this movie came out, I was working at a church in Tennessee, and a lot of the members had seen it, and it was something that our youth group had seen. And one of my best friends there, he watched it. He knew I was going to watch it the next week, and he just loved it. It was faith-affirming. He thought it was well done. It was fantastic. He actually said, "I cried in it." This guy cried in a lot of movies. He cried in it, and he looked at me, and he said, "We'll see what you think." So I watched it the next weekend, and the first words out of his mouth when he saw me, "You watched it, didn't you?" "Yeah, yeah." "You hated it, didn't you?" And I said, "Well, hate's a strong word." But let me tell you a little bit about this movie. So the main character is this coach. He's a high school football coach and a teacher at a Christian academy somewhere in the South. And so he's a really good man, but he's going through a lot of tough times. So he's been there for, I don't know, 5-6 years. They've not yet had a winning season. The players' parents are starting to say, "We should get rid of this guy because he stinks. He can't even win a football game." His salary at this private school, it's not great. So financially, he's kind of strapped. A lot of stuff in his house is breaking. His car breaks down several times in the movie, and that becomes a little important at this critical point when it breaks down, and he breaks down at that moment. His last big crisis is he and his wife want to have kids, and they can't have children. They've been struggling with this, and they find out right after they lose the last game that it's because of him. He's the reason they can't have kids. So he's coming home, his car breaks down again. And that's when he just breaks down and he dedicates his life to God again. And he says, I'm gonna make sure I commit everything I'm doing to praising you, no matter how bad it gets. If I get fired, if I lose every game, if we never have kids, I'm gonna commit to you, and I'm gonna teach my students, and I'm gonna teach my players that, and that's going to be my focus. And he does that. In the movie, you probably know where I'm going, right? It's kind of predictable. It completely turns around. He inspires the players. All of a sudden, this same bunch of kids who couldn't, put together a winning drive to save their lives, now they start winning football games. They do it really well. I love sports movies, and this is they do this the whole season. They do it pretty well. He turns the season around. They win the state championship. During this whole process, the message to the players is encouraging. A lot of the players start behaving better and clean up their lives. And one of the parents, who's got a lot of money, anonymously gives the coach a brand new truck. It's a real nice truck. So that's taken care of. The school board, before he even wins games that much, they say, "You know what? Instead of firing this dude, maybe we should just give him a 20 or 30% raise." So they give him a big raise. So, he's able to replace his broken down fridge and his dishwasher. And then right after they win the championship game, his wife comes up to him, not like, "I'm pregnant." They cut forward at the epilogue, right there at the end, and he's got a toddler running around his house, and I can't remember if his wife's pregnant again or they just have another baby, but there's at least two kids, there may be three. He still has that nice shiny truck, his house is looking better, and they cut to the trophy case in the school. They just won like state championship after state championship, just two or three or four in a row. If this wasn't a Christian movie, I would probably think, man, that's exactly what I want. I want this happily ever met. All of us do, right? We want to see the protagonist go through a terrible time and then come out and win everything. But the thing that bothered me about it so much was that it seemed to tie together this guy's faith and dedication to this earthly success, where, you know, these things that are totally out of his control. It's not like he was out, you know, smoking and drinking and blowing his money on gambling, and that's why he had no money, and that's why he was having health problems, and that's why his team was losing, because he was a bum. No, he was a good guy. But when he recommitted, because he wasn't committed enough before, when he recommitted, all of a sudden, all these things outside of his control just went perfect. So when this was going on, when this movie was coming out, here's what was going on, some of the things in the church I was at. There was a couple who was a young couple, been married just a few years, very active in our church's youth group and the children's ministry, volunteering and all kinds of stuff. They started pulling back from all that. You know, all of us thought, wow, when are they going to have kids? You know, we didn't say it, but we were thinking it. And we come to realize it's because they can't. And it's killing them. It's killing them to be serving all the kids in the church and all these babies that are all over the place, and they can't have one. So they pull back some. We had a deacon in our church, just a great guy. Fantastic leader in our body. He'd been battling cancer for about 4 years, and he died. He left behind a wife who stayed home to take care of their two little kids. And another one that makes it even tougher. There was a couple that we got to know, and the husband had this rare genetic disorder. And this genetic disorder didn't actually give him any symptoms, so he was fine, and he could pass it on to his kids, and they could be fine too. But if he married a woman with a different genetic disorder, which his wife had, and she didn't have any symptoms either, and she didn't know anything about it, but there was a 1 in 4 chance that any kid that they had would die within an hour of birth, because the brain wouldn't develop enough to take care of and maintain their body and keep their organs functioning. They'd lost their first son back in 01, which is about when Asher was born. They lost their second son in 04, about 2 months after Gabriel was born. So here I am. I've got two sons the ages of the two they lost. And I see this movie and I'm thinking, it doesn't work that way. And I don't know how helpful this is. I'm not being fair to the people who made this movie. I got to tell you that. It's a good movie. It's fun to watch. You can watch it with everyone in your family. It's clean, which says a lot. But I remember being in the hospital room with Rylan and holding that little boy, praying for a miracle. And I'm not going to say how much I dedicated my life to God. That's a different thing. But I wasn't alone. I was filled. There was this room filled with people in their family who were weeping, praying for a miracle. And I can't speak for everybody in that room, but I know I believe that God could do that. I still do. I believe most of the people in that room thought God could have saved that boy. We had a church and an active prayer ministry. We'd been praying for this family for months because of the high risk. They did the test. They knew that this was a likelihood. And then they got the diagnosis that, Ryland's got the same genetic disorder. He's going to die. So we've been praying for months that God would work a miracle and save this kid. And if you haven't told, if I haven't told you the story before, then you probably can guess. I held him just a few minutes before he died. And I gave a eulogy at his funeral. And I talked to his dad a couple of months later when he was about to commit suicide. He didn't, thankfully. But and I remember walking into our auditorium where Bob was laid out in the casket. The service was later that afternoon, and I went in there alone, and there was no one in the room with me. And I just read John 11 before I went in, where Jesus raised Lazarus 3 days after he died. I'm walking in, I've got this Bible in my hand, my finger's still on John 11. It's like, I know you can do this. I know you can. Will you? Please. We buried Bob later that afternoon. So the problem I have with a movie like that, and is the theology, they didn't actually preach that theology, just to be clear. He didn't actually say, if you do this, your life's going to be rosy and great and rainbows and unicorns. They didn't say that. But the theology that I felt behind it, especially when so many in our church were walking through these terrible trials that were out of their control, was that it left in your mind this idea that if I just am good enough, bad things won't happen to me. If I'm dedicated enough, if I have enough faith, if I pray often enough, if I read my Bible enough, then I'll be spared this pain. And there was just example after example. I just gave you three. I could have gone on for another hour. I could go on for an hour about this. It was a big church. Just like any group of 700 people, we had people going through something all the time. And I really didn't want to be a part of a group that made people feel like that, because then, if that's our theology, then anytime something bad happens to you, it's your fault. It's because of you. You didn't have enough faith. Well, I absolutely reject that. And I think the makers of this movie, that Facing the Giants, they would probably too, but it doesn't change this struggle that I know I've had, and then I think I can't even tell you how many books I've read on it, how many people have come to me to say, why is this happening? What have I done wrong? How can I fix this? And there's this problem statement with Christianity that keeps popping up. In fact, it predates Christianity. It's not just a Christian issue. It's a God issue. You can go back to Genesis and the stories of Abraham. You gave me this great promise. But where is it? Look at Job, and I mean, what a terror story that is. Can you imagine? He lost his entire family. And then later, God gives him more kids, but he still lost, I don't know, he had 6 or 8 of them. I didn't look at it, but he lost his whole family. I'm encouraged that God blessed him later in life with more, but still. So the way it may be phrased, why do bad things happen to good people? Where's God when it hurts? Why would God allow his children, whom he claims to love, to suffer so much when he could remove their suffering completely? How do you deal with being disappointed with God? And in church, we don't talk about that too often. Because, I mean, all of you right now are feeling great, right? Everybody peppy, right? This is the peppy sermon. How do we deal with this disappointment? Is it wrong? Is it wrong to be disappointed with God? We're going to walk through the story of one man through Scripture from birth to death. So it's someone you've are familiar with, I think. So I don't know that how much I need. We're not going to read the whole story. We'd bounce around a little too much. But his story begins in Luke chapter 1. It's another story. There seems that there's so many couples in the Bible who struggled to have children. So it's another one. It's Zechariah and Elizabeth. They're well advanced in years. Everybody thinks they're fantastic human beings. He's a priest. He's a great guy. She's a great lady. They have no kids. He goes into the temple to serve. The angel of the Lord, Gabriel, shows up to him and says, "Your prayers have been answered. You're going to have a baby boy." And Zechariah's response is, "What? I'm really old. So is she. How can I know this?" That's kind of almost, that's almost exactly what he says. How can I know this is going to happen? I'm really old and so is she. And Gabriel's response reminds me of how our Gabriel, we've named our Gabriel after that Gabriel, and our Gabriel says the same thing, "Because I'm Gabriel." And Gabriel says that at our house a whole lot. If he does something, "Why'd you do that?" "Because I'm Gabriel." And so the angel says, "Because I'm Gabriel, and I'm going to now punish you. You can't speak for however many months, you know, 9 months until the baby's born." And that's what happens. His first words after the baby's born are praise to God for this child. And everybody's looking for this wonderful experience of what's this kid going to do. They're amazed at the signs, at the wonders, and the fact that this really old couple has had a baby. So it's a great story. Starts off with a lot of promise. And it gets better. We don't see John again for maybe 30 years. In Matthew 3, he's in the height of his ministry. I don't ever see a number, but it seems like there's hundreds of people gathered out by the river where he's preaching and he's teaching and he's baptizing. And he's pointing to Jesus coming. And he's known Jesus his whole life. You know, back in Luke, the story is when his mother's pregnant with him, Mary shows up to visit. And John leaps in the womb. I don't know exactly what that felt like. Some of you may. That seems a little alarming to me. But he leaps in the womb because Mary showed up. And so his whole life he's known, "I'm the precursor for my cousin, Jesus. He's the man. I'm the guy coming first, he's the man." So he's out here in the wilderness, baptizing people, preaching. Jesus actually shows up. I don't know what you'd be expecting at this point. I'd be thinking some kind of great transition where, you know, "Hey, I hear you got 12 openings on your team." You know, I would think I'd be one of the 12, right? Maybe one of the top three. Well, I'd get crazy with that, but, you know, one of the 12. Wouldn't you think that? I would think that. Or maybe instead it'd be like, "You know what? I've been out here in the wilderness for 20 years, maybe. I've been eating bugs. I'm tired of bugs, Jesus. I'd like to settle down, get a job and marry, maybe live back in town and eat something else. Maybe a retirement." None of that happens. Jesus shows up. John baptizes him. This amazing affirmation from heaven, the earth, the heavens open up. A dove comes down. The voice says, "This is my son whom I love." John sees it all. He hears it. He's right there. And then we don't see John again. Jesus' ministry takes off. And now, a couple years later, it sounds like Jesus' ministry is at its peak. So in Matthew 10, Jesus just sent out the 12. The 12 went out. They went preaching. They were performing miracles. They come back excited. They're reporting all the amazing things that happened. And then Jesus is still meeting with them, and some disciples of John come up to him. So in Matthew 11, we see what's happened to John and why his ministry has taken a nosedive. In verse 2, when John heard in prison what Christ was doing, so let's stop that. He's in prison. We find out in Matthew 14 why he's in prison. During his preaching about repentance, there's a really terrible family that we hear about, the Herods, and they're horrible. He was condemning the one brother who took his other brother's wife, who happened to also be both of them's niece, as his wife. And that's how he was living now. So that's what Herod, the king of Galilee at the time, that's what he had done. And you know, the wife Herodias, because everybody needs to have Herod in their name, right? Herodias, she was all on board with it because she went from being the wife of a nobleman to the wife of the king, so she went along with it. So that's, John was calling them out for living a lifestyle that's wrong, and they put him in prison for that. So John's in prison, and he asks a question. I haven't really paid a whole lot of attention to this question before. It's a weird question. It's not a question I would expect from John. I don't know if it's one you would expect from John. Are you the one who was to come? Or should we look for someone else? Think about that for a second. He leaped in the womb when Mary, who was pregnant, came to visit. His whole life has been leading up to this transition to introduce the world to Jesus. Jesus is here. Jesus' ministry is doing great. John's on the decline. He's in prison. Are you really the one? I mean, I know we heard that voice from heaven and that dove, and that was cool. But that was a couple years ago. It's been a rough couple years. If I were writing this story, this is when Jesus would say, yeah, there's going to be an earthquake tonight. Your jail cell is going to pop open. The guards are going to fall asleep in terror. You can walk right out, and then you can join me and be my right-hand man in the kingdom. That's not what happens. Things like that do happen in Acts with other people, but not with John. Instead, Jesus' answer, and this is kind of an answer. It is an answer, but it's probably not a very satisfying one for John. That's probably the way I should say it. Go back and report to John what you hear and see. The blind receive sight, the lame walk, those who have leprosy are cured, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, and the good news is preached to the poor. That's great news. That's amazing. It doesn't help John at all. It really isn't, in the least, if I was John, what I'd want to hear. So the reason I want to go through, John is disappointed with God. This isn't what I thought was going to happen. My life's not turning out the way I thought. Didn't I do everything you ask? I don't think any of us could really compare our lives to what he's done. Jesus then follows that up with a statement that just really makes me wonder what's going on. Blessed is the man who does not fall away on account of me. I don't know how much that's been the memory verse that you like wrote on the board, on your mirror and taped up there so you'd remember it all. Any of you did that? Any of you put this one on? Anyone? No takers? Yeah, I haven't either. Blessed is the man who does not fall away because of me. There's a couple of things I get from that, but maybe the one that I like the most. Is that Jesus isn't angry with him. He doesn't condemn him at all. Let's skip forward just a few chapters to 14. Things for John go from bad to worse. On Herod's birthday, the daughter of Herodias danced for them and pleased Herod so much that he promised with an oath to give her whatever she asked. Prompted by her mother, she said, "Give me here on a platter the head of John the Baptist." That's a twisted family. The king was distressed, but because of his oaths and his dinner guests, he ordered that her request be granted and had John beheaded in the prison. His head was brought in on a platter and given to the girl who carried it to her mother. John's disciples came and took his body and buried it. Then they went and told Jesus. Not the story I was hoping for John. I'm going to tell you straight up. Not what I wanted. I don't know how John's disciples felt. We know that some of his disciples became disciples of Jesus. I don't know how many. I wonder how many were discouraged by this event and thought, how can I be part of this ministry if this is how people are treated? I don't know. In so many ways, it feels like, and I'm not even, I didn't go through the years of prison. I didn't, it feels like John was cast aside. And from the question he sent to Jesus, I get the idea that maybe he felt that at least sometimes too. At least some of the time. Why would he let John the Baptist be killed? Don't you think John would have been a really good leader of the church a couple of years later? The praise Jesus had for John is pretty high. Back in Matthew 11, Jesus says, "I tell you the truth, among men, among those born of women, there has not risen anyone greater than John the Baptist." That's high praise, straight from Jesus. I would think he would have been a real rock for the church in the days and months after the resurrection if he'd still been alive. But that's not the way the story turns out. Here's what I do know. Just a few months after John's beheading, we have another leader who's struggling with the plan of God. We have another leader who's expressing his concern for the direction things are heading and asking for a way out. And in a lot of ways, I would say expressing some disappointment with how this is happening and how things are unfolding. In Matthew 26, 38, Jesus says, "My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death." He goes on to ask for another way besides the cross. Of course, we know he submits to God's will. Of course, we know he goes to the cross. But even on the cross, the quote that most of us are probably the most familiar with when he's on the cross, or at least one of them, is, my God, why have you forsaken me?" So again, I know this is a bit of a downer on a Sunday morning. I get it. Aren't you glad you came to church this morning? If you weren't disappointed with God when you showed up, maybe you are now. You're welcome for that. Let me try to leave you with a few things, because to me, this is a very real struggle that I think is a part of the Christian experience eventually for all of us. First, it's not wrong to feel that way. Let me say that again. It's not wrong to be disappointed with God. If John the Baptist and Jesus could do it, and so many other people throughout Scripture who went through trials and wondered, "Where are you, God? Please help us, save us now." And the now was a different timetable, or the saving was in a different way than they would ever have dreamed or wanted. But it's not wrong to feel that way. One of the things I really want to emphasize, God has big shoulders. He can handle my disappointment. I don't think it's going to bother him. I don't think it's going to weigh him down if I get disappointed because things are tough. The second thing I want you to get from this is it's not just you. If you're going through a disappointing time with God right now and you're really struggling with the way things are happening, I do want you to hear that. It's not just you. I can't imagine that most of the people in the room, especially those of us who are a little older, we've gone through this to some degree or another. And we're in great company again with Jesus and John the Baptist, but then also with Paul and Abraham and Peter, and the list goes on. What really I love about the gospel story is that we get this view of Jesus going through it too. You know, Paul writes that Jesus went through everything we did. And here's where he goes through a disappointment with how the will of God is unfolding. Doesn't mean he didn't follow it, but he didn't like the way it was unfolding. He wanted it to be different for him. Third thing, your circumstances don't depict how God feels about you. Remember what he said about John the Baptist. Among those born of women, that's everyone but Adam and Eve. Among those born of women, there has never risen anyone greater than John. Out of billions of people, John's the number one. And he was disappointed with God. And he was in a horrible spot. God loved him in that spot. And his love for John wasn't nullified by the circumstances that John was in. Being in an overwhelming trial or great suffering does not mean you're outside the love of God at all. I don't know about it for you, but it feels like to me sometimes that's when God has loved me the most. And that's when God's called me to do something that I needed to be prepared for and I wasn't. The last thing I want to leave you with is this. Even though we don't always see it, God has a plan. I absolutely do not understand the plan of God. And I'm not just talking about the plan for my life and my family's life or the future. I mean, I don't understand God's plan for John the Baptist. If I was writing this story, I would have made him one of the 12. When Jesus is resurrected and ascends into heaven, I'd have been saying, John, you the man, you take over. You keep it going, brother. That's what I would have done. It probably would have blown up in my face. I'm sure it would have, right? Because that's not what God did. But from my perspective, that seems like the right thing, but it wasn't. There's a quote from a book that Philip Yancey wrote called Disappointment with God. And this quote is, faith means believing in advance what will only make sense in reverse. God has a plan. I don't always understand it. I don't always need to know it. But I just need to believe that he has it. This is a difficult topic. I think if of all the things that people struggle with in Christianity, I wouldn't say this is number one. I think the number one thing is probably how we act. That's the number one thing I think people struggle with about Christians. About Christianity. But I think number two is probably this. why do bad things happen to good people? And where is God when it's suffering and all this bad stuff happening? Why doesn't God stop it? And I think this is it. And when people raise either one of those two objections, I kind of get it, and I want to talk to them more. And this is one where I definitely think it's a conversation that we should have. I don't know anybody who's an expert at it. All I know is it's where we come alongside each other and we don't throw scripture at one another and hit each other with Bibles and try to make it go away because I can quote Romans 8:28 really fast. I believe Romans 8:28, that all things work together for the good of those who love the Lord. I believe that. But I did not bring that up when I was in a hospital room with the baby who was dying. That would have been the wrong thing to do. Often you just need to be there. So, we're about to sing a song, and what I want to just call out and invite you to is if you're struggling with something, if you're feeling disappointed with God, and you want to share something with someone, and it can be something public or private, it could be something you just want to have somebody pray with you, we'd love for you to come up and as the worship team's coming up, we'll pray with you. We'll wrap our arms around you, and we'll see what we can do to help you and walk alongside you during this time, because so much of what our community is supposed to be about is how we walk together through these trials. And you know, Dion just preached, it's been a few months now, about all these one another passages. This is where we do the one another. This is where we cry with each other. We love one another. We help one another. And we would love for you to invite us into that with you and to be part of the struggle you're feeling, to help you carry the burden, because there's going to come a time when all of us are going to probably be feeling the same way. If you haven't been baptized, if Gary talked about it earlier about the Ethiopian eunuch being baptized. We talked about a little bit when Jesus was baptized. If you haven't been baptized and you'd like to do that today, we can do that as well. So if you would, stand up and we'll sing.